Good morning, everyone. This is Brandon with the Iowa Healthcare Association, and welcome to our Fridays from the State House call. It's our second one, January 27th, 2023. These calls are sponsored by our contract lobbyist, Cornerstone Government Affairs, and so we work pretty closely with them throughout the entire year, but especially during our legislative session when they're down at the Capitol every day, working issues for many of their clients, but Iowa Healthcare Association being one of those. So thanks to them for their sponsorship of our calls. With that, I'll turn it to Maria, who's going to kick us off with what's been happening for long-term care over this last week. So Maria, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Brandon, and happy Friday, everyone. As Brandon said, we want to give you an update on a weekly basis here about some of the things that are happening at the Capitol with regard to our sectors. And, week three of session was a busy one. Honestly, it wasn't quite as nasty as the first 2 weeks of the legislative session, which isn't saying a whole lot, but we are starting to kind of find our cadence here when it comes to the legislature. They are still introducing bills and study bills and things of that nature. So a lot of subcommittee action this last week, and then here moving forward until the first funnel for the legislature, which is at the beginning of March. So we just, again, attending a lot of subcommittees, learning on a daily basis. We go through the bill book, which comes out at the end of the day, in the House and Senate journals to look at the new bills that have been introduced. And we're starting to see a lot of movement, like I said. And again, I don't think that those bills will slow down probably for another, maybe three, four weeks. So, but as always, we try to address all those issues that we think are critical and that can impact you all when it comes to providing care to the folks in your communities. So, we just ask again, just as a quick reminder, that you not share the call access information with non-member organizations. Again, as this is this call is just a benefit of your IHCA, ICAL, and ICHC membership. So I think I'll just kind of start with some of the things that are happening with regards to our really heavy focus on advocating for funding for all three sectors. We are constantly in conversations with legislators, the governor's office, about the state of our sectors and the funding scenarios. And, what we're doing here to kind of prep for the appropriations bill that will contain the numbers, the dollar amounts in the appropriations for the sectors, what we're doing to kind of prepare for that comes sort of at the end of the legislative session. It's one of the last bills. We usually see that in April. So what we've been doing, Brandon and I, and Jackie has been helpful as well. We've been preparing some packets for us to go in and talk with the new legislators. We have several of them in both chambers, I think 50 some total. And we're just, going in and introducing ourselves and explaining at the most basic level who we are, who we represent, and then also our funding sources. Just again, it's at a very, very basic level. We don't want to overwhelm folks that are new to the legislature. They've got a lot going on the way it is with their first session. So, but we are going in face to face and meeting, introducing ourselves and trying to make an impact on these new lawmakers, the freshman legislators, so that they can connect faces with names. And then we have some leave behind information for them with our policy and legislative agenda, as well as district-specific information regarding long-term care and how it impacts their specific district. So more to come on that. That's going to be a big lift. We started that kind of early this last week, and that will go on for a while because, as I said, we have a lot of new members of the legislature. So that's kind of what we're doing to kind of prepare for, again, those conversations regarding appropriations for our sectors.
One thing I want to add to that, Maria, is part of that packet is a one pager that goes into a little bit. I would almost call it like elementary detail on like what rebasing is, because with those newbies, they don't have a clue. When you say rebasing, they don't have a clue what that means. And mm-hmm. So we kind of give some like a breakdown of how our sectors are funded. And so it really should be able to get them on the page of understanding. Okay, so this is cost. We're paying for cost of what it takes to care for somebody, and we're recalibrating it really. So Just wanted to mention that because I think with those newbies, it's important that they don't have a clue. And even many of the people that are there that have been there for many years may not know exactly what rebasing is. So we'll be using some of that messaging to make sure that they understand what they're funding.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Brandon. And honestly, it's so elementary. When we were writing it, I really used the lens that I needed when I came in, which basically required Brandon to sit down with crayons and explain to me the rebase process because it is so complicated. So we think we've gotten to a good point. And if you ever want a copy of anything like that kind of any of the materials that we share with the legislature, let us know. We're happy to share that information. And again, it's been put in a very basic format that we feel is easily understandable. So feel free to reach out if you want any of those materials to share with anyone or your legislator. So, okay, so moving on to some of the bills that we've seen a little bit of movement on this week. Well, I guess initially the first two that I'm going to talk about, I did mention last week and I haven't seen any movement on them, but one of the bills that we discussed in our last call would create a CON process for assisted living programs, again, which we do not want. We know it's unnecessary. So we did voice our concerns with the bill to the legislator. He did that proposed it, and he did agree not to move the bill, and he has stood by that. They did assign it a subcommittee, but we talked to the chair of the Health and Human Resources Committee, and he has agreed not to move the bill, so we don't anticipate it getting any movement whatsoever. But again, just something to keep an eye on. Last week, I also mentioned a bill, Senate File 5, that would weaken the reporting requirements for staffing agencies. Again, this was a hell no. So we immediately went and fought to kill that. And again, we do not anticipate it moving forward. There has been no movement, but I'm keeping a very close eye on that because I don't want it to go anywhere. So more to come on that, but we don't anticipate any progress there. House Study Bill 24 and has a companion bill in the Senate Study Bill 1044. And these are DIA proposed bills. This is actually a bill that we requested regarding staffing agencies. So we did request a while back. I know that you're aware of this already through rules. We requested that PT, OT, and speech therapists would be carved out of that staffing agency bill. And this bill by DIA is just codifying that rule so that it's in law. We did at the subcommittee, it did pass, but we did have podiatrists and physician's assistants request to be carved out of that bill also. They were not intended to be a part of this bill in the first place, so we're comfortable with carving them out. So the bill was amended, and it did pass through the subcommittee in the House. So we're waiting on a subcommittee in the Senate, but we don't anticipate any issues there. We think it'll go through. One thing that we do want to mention, and Brandon, feel free to jump in and add anything here, but, you know, we've had conversations. We feel that the bill pretty explicitly, carves out almost everyone we don't want it to impact, and really was written in a way to define direct care so that it was really specific to the types of employees that healthcare employment agencies provide to our members. But it's clear to us with all these requests for carve-outs that maybe that our intention to make it clear, and maybe it's not so clear. So we've had conversations about maybe changing the definition, expanding it so that we don't have to carve out every little, or not every little, but every single industry that doesn't feel they should be included. So we may be working on that in the future, not this year, but that's just something that we've noticed with this bill. So Brandon, anything you want to add on that?
No, I don't think so. I think when you got a multiple different professionals coming to you saying, hey, we want to be excluded. It's like you already are. They're just trying to, cover themselves, I suppose, to make sure that that's not applicable to them, which I get. So that's why we're going to maybe, like Marie mentioned, look into the future at a possible definition change just to really tighten it up so we don't have a laundry list of exclusions from the program or the bill.
Yep. So one bill that was introduced this week that I'm a little bit excited about, and I think it has really good a good possibility of moving forward, was proposed by House Republicans, House Study Bill 63, And it's an act that would create a new resident and new graduate tax credits against an individual's income tax. So this is something that might be helpful for recruiting and retaining talent here in our state. That's a big priority of the governor's office and the legislature in general, and us too, of course. So it seems like it might be a good way that the state can incentivize people to come here or stay after graduation. We've heard a lot about that and how that's problematic. It could apply to all new nurses for up to 4 years if they complete the nursing program. We're looking into whether it would apply to individuals who complete the certified aid programs. But again, we're excited because it could be a good recruiting tool and might really help some of those border cities. So anyway, more to come on that, but we're looking at it. We'll register in favor and keep you posted. We do have two acts related to, or two, I'm sorry, two Senate files related to elder abuse. Senate file 107, I think I briefly touched on this last week, is a fairly significant expansion of elder abuse, vulnerable adult, and financial exploitation. Ultimately, it would strengthen the law against family members who take their elder loved ones' assets. This is something that it may move. We haven't seen any. It was just introduced. It doesn't have a subcommittee assigned yet. So no movement. We definitely don't think that our industry should oppose it. It could be helpful, as I said, with strengthening the law against family members who take advantage of assets. So we'll keep an eye on that one. The second Senate file is Senate file 93, and that relates directly to investigations of dependent adult abuse in a healthcare facility or hospital by DIA. And ultimately what it says, we don't think that this bill will probably move because we feel that it's sort of already being accomplished in law, and there may be some confusion by the senator who's proposed this bill. But it ultimately says DIA shall determine if the dependent adult has an existing guardian, conservator, or attorney in fact. And it requires the department to inform all of those folks. It's basically saying if someone doesn't have a responsible party and we think you need one, that they'll let DHHS know, the Department of Human Services. So again, we feel like this is already happening in many cases, so we're just going to keep an eye on it. But so the big one here that came about this week is relating to non-economic damages against healthcare providers. So we're talking about the medical malpractice provision, House File 102 and Senate File 148. If you want to, if you're interested in going and reading through it, it's pretty dry. So I don't recommend. But in summary, you know, our Iowa's current medical malpractice provisions allow juries to opt out of an existing cap on non-economic damages. So those are intangible damages such as pain, suffering, or inconvenience in certain situations that are outlined. You know, we feel that this undermines the originating purpose of the cap. And one of the greater concerns is that it fosters such an uncertain operating environment for our healthcare providers. You know, they constantly face that ongoing threat of legal action from the trial attorneys. The trial bar is very opposed to caps. As you can see, it's been quite a fight this week between the opposed and the supporters with regards to this issue. But we have seen, you know, those kinds of, you know, ridiculous exorbitant awards by multiple juries throughout the state over the past several years. So, you know, we feel that really it's hurting our recruiting and retaining efforts in Iowa when it comes to medical professionals. They're very hesitant to work here. And, you know, that in and of itself poses extreme challenges to our state's healthcare network. And really our providers' efforts, again, to recruit and retain physicians, particularly in those rural areas. So we'll be sending out a call to action on this. You know, the status of the bill in the House is that it has passed the subcommittee. It is scheduled for a full committee on Monday at 5 p.m. We believe that they have the votes for that to pass the full committee, and then it'll go to the House floor. In the Senate, it has passed the subcommittee and the full committee, and will probably be on the debate calendar next week here. So, Brandon, you want to talk a little bit about the call to action?
Yeah, so we're in the process of developing a call to action for members, and you may remember having received one of these probably each of the last couple of years, at least In 21, I know we did a formal call to action with all of our membership. Last year, we did a more targeted one where there were struggles in getting some votes in line. And so this year, again, we're gonna do more of a general blast out to members to reach out to their legislators and asking them to support it. And so, like Maria said, when it'll be going to full committee next week, so that call to action would definitely be early next week, probably Monday morning to afternoon, to when you'll receive that. And so, especially with the timeline of, you know, the House having their full, discussion on it, on Monday evening, time will be of the essence to act and make an outreach to your House members. And then obviously with the Senate occurring a little bit later, we think we're not entirely sure on that date yet, right, Maria, on Senate?
Yeah, and there may be a public commentary meeting as well, probably at the beginning of next week, which just means that people from the public can come in and talk about their experiences and their opinions regarding the bill and its impact. But I believe that by the end of next week, it'll be on the debate floor and we'll probably either pass or die. We'll know.
So yeah, you can expect that to come out from us early Monday. So then please reach out to your elected officials and ask them to support the cap on non-economic damages. So we got some text and a sample email for you to send. So it should be pretty easy.
Yep. Yeah, thank you. We just can't emphasize enough the importance of reaching out directly to your lawmakers. So we'll be bugging you like crazy about that here coming up. But I do want to give just one more update. We did put in a request. I know we've mentioned this in the past for one-time appropriation through the ARPA grant. We have not made much progress on that specifically. We're still working with the governor's office there, but we have been working on some other exciting things, and we saved the best news for last. yeah, really, we've actually, this has been something that we've been doing in collaboration and working with the Department of Human Services and the governor's office for about six months or so. We've been in discussions with them regarding the skilled nursing facility quality assurance assessment fee, the QAF. So I'm not going to explain what the QAF is, but it does generate new funding through federal matching and then distribution of those increases directly to providers who basically deliver services to Medicaid beneficiaries. So the exciting news here is that we are currently, Iowa is currently set at 3.95% of revenues paid in, but IHCA proposed to DHHS an increase to 6%, and we have agreement on that. And I'll let Brandon get into any more details regarding the specifics of that, but it sounds like it'll be effective April 1st. Again, all of this is subject to CMS approval because a state plan amendment has to be submitted for that. But we feel really good about it. We would never announce it if we didn't feel confident and that we were on the same page. But again, that's just some exciting news regarding the QAF. So Brandon, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, I think with that, April 1 is the marching orders that the department received as far as an effective date of the program. I do know that they obviously have to do a public comment period. They'll be submitting the SPA. CMS will have time to review it and respond. Ideally, it's approved. This is not acting outside of the law. 6% is the max a state can do. There's many states that are already at 6% and many more that are moving to 6% this year or in the near future in other states. So with that, we feel pretty comfortable. I would also say that we will likely not have rates on April 1st, the rate sheets with the new QAF. It will be effective April 1st, but we will likely not have them in hand on April 1st. I would anticipate those to be likely received in the middle or later in April. Obviously, for our purposes, it's best to have them prior to billing for April services. And most of that billing occurs within that first week of May or April. So we're really trying to push them on the timeline to get those out to you all and, of course, the MCOs before that, prior to that end of April timeline. One piece of important, or hopefully everyone's doing this, but it's important to know that you should be billing at a usual and customary charge anyways to help to capture that increase in the rates that will happen because of this increase of the provider tax program. So make sure that you are billing a usual and customary charge that is in excess of, I'll have to look it up, but that is significantly in excess of the amounts that will be coming through this program. I'll try to find that number while we're wrapping up the call so that way you know for sure. But either way, the point holds true. Billing usual and customary charges is the best way to go when it comes to retroactive reprocessing of claims. So obviously, if you are billing in excess, there will never be an issue or should not be an issue to where you're not, your Medicaid rate goes above that amount and would require you to do some manual billing reprocessing. If you are billing a usual and customary charge that is higher than what your rates are, then any changes to rates would be able to be automatically reprocessed by the MCO. So really that's time saver for providers because we don't have to do any rebilling of those services. So I'll try to find at least to give you an estimate on what the rate change will do. Now, keep in mind that if the rate goes up a certain amount, there's obviously pay-in for you all with the provider tax program. So that's not like your net gain because there's obviously an added cost by having to pay in additional fees. But the net gain to the sector is probably net money about $15 a day. So just for round number, I guess, purposes. But that's kind of what I would add to the conversation here on QA, Maria. And I don't know if you have anything else that you want to go into.
No, I think that's very helpful. And there'll be a lot of guidance here coming down the pipeline as this unfolds. And again, we're just kind of spending a lot of time right now making sure that those timelines are met and those deadlines for the SPA submittal and those kinds of things. So we'll keep you posted there, but there will be significant guidance coming out. The only other thing that I wanted to mention is that with regards to the elderly waiver and some of our home health services, I wanted to make sure I mentioned that you may have seen in our policy and legislative agenda this year, we have a lot of things that are specific to streamlining processes and, making it, improving access in the way of making it a little more manageable to provide certain types of services, HCBS services. And those things, while they may not be happening, those conversations as much in the legislature, those are things that we are still talking with the relevant departments, DIA, DHHS, about how we can accomplish those things. And I wanted to mention that, Brandon and Julie, we were invited to take part in an HCBS conversation by the Department of Health and Human Services about what they can do to assist us in making it, in improving access and making it easier for us to provide HCBS services. So I think that's been an excellent opportunity. Brandon and Julie have done a really, really nice job of giving them ideas. We have a million of them, but a bunch of ideas on how they can make it, easier for our providers and improve access, particularly in those rural areas. So we'll keep you posted on those kinds of things. Brandon, I don't know if there's anything specific you want to update with regards to the specific policies that we're stumping for.
At least in as far as the call goes, that we actually have that here starting at 10:30. So I'll need to jump to that for those members. But really it's improving the ability or allowing for home health providers or new home health providers to enter into the sector easier. I know one of the biggest hurdles when becoming a new provider is oftentimes the amount of patients you need to serve in order and be surveyed on before you can actually start to bill for the services. That's a major hurdle that we're trying to push back on. If the state has any ability on their end to maybe start maybe pay for at least the Medicaid clients that you're serving. So That's one thing that we're looking at. Mileage is another thing that's being tossed around for home health, paying at least a portion of mileage. And so there's a few other, you know, flexibility type pieces, but those are the ones that are mostly being floated right now. So it's a good conversation.
Say, Brandon, hey, sorry to interrupt. This is Dave. But before you hop off, have they committed to actually a guaranteed or a planned submission date for the SPA, for the QAF change?
They haven't told us a date in which they will submit. I think that we have impressed upon them by the end of this month is important to help retain that anticipated timeline for approval.
So by Tuesday then is what?
That is our thought. I would say that they have the marching orders to pursue the program changes with an effective date of 4/1. And so as long as they know that they can meet that timeline, I think I don't necessarily have a date that they're going to submit it, but I think that they know that they need to have it so it's effective 4/1. So whatever they need to do to get that done is the orders they are given.
All right.
And we'll verify that, Dave. We'll have, you know, Brandon is in contact with some of the folks at the department almost on a daily basis. So we'll reach out again today and verify that. But that's the kind of the follow-up stuff that we're doing to make sure they stay on track.
Right. It'd be reassuring to hear him say, yep, we're submitting it on Tuesday or Wednesday or whatever, and see if we could get him to commit to that anyway.
Yep.
In the spirit of paranoia and
which is understandable.
Well,
that's really all I have, unless anyone has questions. Okay. Well, as usual, feel free to reach out to us if anything comes up or is on your mind or you want us to share any information. And we're happy to get it to you. But otherwise, like I said, feel free to reach out and have a safe and happy weekend.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, guys.